Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Welcome to Mind, Brain, and Body with Dr. Michael John Kell. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the host, guest, and callers. Now helping you live a more productive and fulfilling life, Dr. Michael John Kell.
Good morning, good evening. I guess it's morning in some parts of the world and evening in others, but perhaps the evening for me. But I'm back traveling again, so I'm on my cell phone, so I will do my best to be clear. Unfortunately, a lot of places in the world actually don't really have landlines that are all workable. But today we're actually talking to someone that Brian and I spoke to you about, and with, I don't know, maybe a couple months ago, about a really cool book called Buddhist Brain, and in the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom. And we were talking to Dr. Rick Hansen, who's got a billion things in his life and lectures all over the world, and a lot of people are famous in mind, brain, body, know him and respect him. And so that's what we're talking a little bit about the book today. And I think last time when Brian and I were talking with Rick, we sort of talked more about just the philosophical basis and the practical basis, but maybe we can get a little more into the neuroscience of he's covering his book of you know, how we're sort of programmed, unfortunately, to survive in life, which means we've been naturally programmed to be a little bit more oriented towards the negative, and how you can help fix that by realizing how it is. So, good morning, Rick. I hope you're doing fine.
Excellent. Good morning to you.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
I'm trying to move around this apartment. Okay, great. So, I don't know where you would like to get started. I'm trying to think where we finished last time, but it was such a long time ago.
Yeah.
But maybe you know how it works. You can always change, where we're going and stuff. But I think a lot of people, unless they actually read a lot about neuroscience or study a lot about neuroscience and psychology and psychiatry and, really into self-help stuff, don't really appreciate how much of our behavior is really pre-programmed into us, either inherently through our genetic structure of a brain or because of how we've been brought up. And I think it's an important subject. It's something that's important to realize. Because sometimes I find is when you realize that you actually have a lot of restrictions on yourself, you actually become freer because you learn how to deal with them.
Right.
So maybe you can just start somewhere in there. Or I can ask you a very specific question. How to be happy.
Oh, sure. Well, it's such a large territory. I think the more that you can focus us on what your listeners will be most interested in, that probably would be the best thing. I mean, just some facts that boggle my mind, maybe as a hors d'oeuvre here. You've got this, I routinely reflect about what the actual brain is, right? It's 3 pounds, it's gushy, it looks like mushy cauliflower, essentially. And yet, it's what Sherrington called the enchanted bloom, right? It's continually weaving our moment-to-moment experience for better and for worse, right? Including the sights we see, the sounds we hear, the sensations, the thoughts we have, hopes, dreams, sorrows, longings, joys, and all the rest of that. How in the world does it do that? It's big and complicated. Big in the sense that it's got 1.1 trillion cells, 100 billion neurons. Typical neuron makes about 5,000 connections with other neurons. That gives you about 500 trillion synapses. And they're firing 5 to 50 times a second, sending information around inside the brain and the nervous system altogether. Maybe that's in the time it takes for you to take a breath, a few seconds worth, maybe something on the order of a quadrillion little bits, like in computer lingo, zeros and ones, bits of information moved inside your skull. I mean, it boggles the mind. I mean, it's literally the brain, 3 pounds of mushy cauliflower, is the most complex object known to science, more complex than an exploding star, more complex than, the world economy. It's really quite complicated. So the question, of course, is focus. Where do we start? And I'm like you, very practical. I want to give people things that are actually useful for them. So, you know, in this context, maybe you could tee us up here with some particular point of entry into this conversation.
Well, okay. Let me think here for a second.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Yeah. In a moment there. But one thing, you know, we've been discussing some of our shows with other guests and stuff for some reason, it's been coming up a lot, it's how to be mindful, you know, how to learn to pay attention, how to focus your attention, how to keep it focused on things that are useful and stuff. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about being mindful and the neurophysiology that you know so far about being mindful is. Because I think that's like one of the most critical things that, you know, to be able to really do is to be mindful. Because if you're not mindful, you can't do loving kindness. If you can't do loving kindness, you're not as kind and as sweet as you could be, and your life is much more unhappy.
That's a great topic. Yeah. Well, to kind of set it up, you probably know the famous saying, neurons that fire together or wire together. It's the idea of what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity, or the fact that as information flows through the nervous system, which is what neuroscientists, you know, me included, define as the mind, in it, typically, that's what it really usually boils down to. It's the notion that a physical substrate is representing non-physical information, much as the physical marks on a page represent non-physical meaning of, you know, the words you're reading, let's say, or the, you know, physical hard drive in a computer represents the non-physical patterns of information that constitute a song. Okay, so that's what I mean by mind, and I'm going to stay inside that frame. I'm not going to bounce out to metaphysical, transcendental questions, which, although I do think there's some X factor at work, I'm going to stay inside the frame of Western science. So inside that frame, neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, as information flows, it leaves structure behind. But it does so massively on steroids, you know, turbocharged for what flows through, you know, the field of conscious attention, what we're specifically attentive to. So what we're aware of, to be sure, but in particular what we're attentive to. I think of awareness as sort of like a stage. And there's a spotlight, you know, and whoever's under the spotlight gets most of our attention, although we're dimly aware of what's sort of in the shadows on the stage. And then what's off stage, we're unconscious of. We're not aware of that. So what's under the spotlight gets, you know, gets basically sucked into your brain. I think of attention as a spotlight and vacuum cleaner. You know, it illuminates what it rests upon and then sucks it into your brain, leaving structure behind, for better or worse. So, you know, there's a traditional saying that the mind takes the shape of what it rests upon. You could update that in terms of experience-dependent neuroplasticity and realize that the brain takes the shape that the mind rests upon. So if the mind routinely rests on resentments, regrets, you know, that kind of yammering case in the back of the head about the people we live with, work with, sleep with, whatever, you know, over time the brain will take the shape of anxiety, depressed mood, low resilience, sensitivity, irritability, you know, the sensitization that ensues from chronic stress, because whenever you're upset, it triggers the same reactive machinery that evolved to get us away from chasing lions and all the rest. On the other hand, you know, if the mind rests upon, let's say, themes of gratitude for what legitimately is good in one's life. I'm looking out my window right now, and I see some early spring flowers in my camellia bush, pink, lovely. That's an opportunity to feel good. Or if one rests the mind upon the good qualities that are natural to oneself, no halo required, you know, qualities like patience or determination or fairness and so on. Or if one rests one's mind on the moment-to-moment sort of interaction with others, it's nice, like, you're being nice to me. I mean, we're not best friends. It's okay. It is what it is. And there's a basic goodwill that I can feel coming from you, and that's an opportunity for me to take that in. So, you know, if we rest the mind in those ways over time, the brain will take the shape of things like self-confidence, self-worth, feeling good, greater resilience, much more capacity to deal with the tough things in life, and all the rest of that. And it's better for or worse. That's why getting control of that spotlight is really important, because where you rest that spotlight really gradually, bit by bit, shapes your brain. The problem is most people don't have very good control of that spotlight. It bounces around. That's why William James, the godfather of American psychology, said 100 years ago that an education of attention would be an education par excellence. In other words, the best of all education, inattention. So the question is, of course, how to get control of that spotlight. That's where mindfulness training comes in. To be mindful, let's define that word carefully, to be mindful is to sustain attention to some particular thing, all right? So that means keeping the spotlight where you want it. And it means resting the spotlight on the things that are good for you and pulling the spotlight away from the things that are not good for you. Again, there too, most people don't have very good control of their spotlight with regard to the ways it gets hijacked by negative themes, you know, endless worry, anxious rumination, irritable grumbling in the mind, you know, self-criticism. You know, people keep lashing themselves with a whip way beyond the point that has any usefulness at all. You know, because the brain takes the shape of what it rests upon, if you're resting it upon negative themes past the point that's useful or necessary, you know, you're just doing one more lap in hell, digging the track deeper every time you go around the lap. So that's another reason why getting good control of that spotlight's important, so you can pull it away from the stuff that's not good for you. Okay. The question is how to do it, and it's challenging because, you know, we did not evolve to be all mellow, zen, om-type people, you know. Our ancestors that were super chill, yeah, man, look at the leaves, oh, the light on the leaves, oh, I feel so safe here in the emerald forest, yum, yum, yum. They got eaten, you know. They didn't notice the crackle of the twigs and the bushes nearby or the shadow overhead. You know, the ancestors that evolved, they were like, you know, the birds you see on the ground eating these days, you know, constantly looking over their shoulder. You know, the ancestors that survived were nervous and paranoid and also cranky, right? And we're their great-grandchildren on top of the food chain with nuclear weapons. So, you know, here we are today. And then we have, of course, people varying their temperament. Some are more jackrabbits, you know, kind of real spirited ADHD end of the spectrum where, you know, they're normal temperament. That's normal to be that way. It's not a pathology inherently, but that's how they are. They're jackrabbits, right? They're constantly looking around. They need stim. On the other end, you've got the turtles, right, who are more able to zero in on something but not so good at exploration. So, you know, you have temperament. And then you have culture. We have a real ADD culture. We're constantly bombarded with stimuli. We habituate to it. It's like giving candy to little kids. They don't notice the sweetness of apples anymore. You know, they've habituated to a much more intense stimulus to a fault. So these days we're so habituated to an unbelievably intense incoming baud rate, like we're drinking from the fire hose all day long, that, you know, we need that, you know, we crave that. So that takes us to mindfulness training. And there are many ways to train attention. Some people mean mindfulness as you're basically sustaining attention to some object of attention, whether it's the breath in meditation, let's say, or, frankly, if you're a burglar sneaking through a house. Mindfulness is neutral. It's, you know, it's just sustained attention. People also mean mindfulness to essentially as a synonym for self-awareness. You know, someone who's really mindful, you know, or the way of mindfulness is self-awareness. Okay, that's fine. And then also sometimes people mean by mindfulness a kind of general attitude or approach to life of acceptance and, you know, kind of, you know, gentle curiosity and friendliness toward one's mind, kind of a flowing, you know, way of being. Here I'm really meaning it in terms of being able to control that spotlight. I'm meaning it in terms of the first meaning. So how do you train attention? I actually have a chapter on that in my book, you know, Buddhist Brain, and because it's hard to train attention. I have a long background in meditation and contemplative practice, and one thing that has struck me as a guy who's gone far with that is that it's hard to actually steady the mind. So how do you do it? You know, what are some neurologically savvy ways to actually steady the mind? And if you like, I'll tell listeners, you know, they could even do a little practice right now if you want to do this live on Voice America. But,
that'd be perfect.
You know, these five, for me, they're like six really good neurologically savvy ways to steady attention that you can use just to keep your head straight in a business meeting or to keep your mind in the game, you know, when you're talking to your partner and he or she has a problem and it's probably you, you know, or if you're trying to meditate.
She thinks
right?
It's you.
Right. You want me to do that?
Yeah,
to go into those concrete practices?
Nice. I like this proactive real-life stuff.
Okay, great. All right, so I'll do this kind of fast, you know, and people can unpack it, and also they can listen to this on a recording and slow it down. And I should say,
and buy your book.
Well, yeah. Well, apart from that, actually, you don't even need to buy the book. I even have something that's absolutely free, which is to say, on my website, and they can get there, BuddhistBrain.com. I have a ton of free material, like a ton, and because I kind of work in that frame of just give it away. And so there are a lot of talks there, including guided practices around steadying the mind. Okay, so here we go. So first one, so let's, if you're doing this, if you want to try this, and just relax while you're listening. Pick something like the sensations of breathing, maybe in your chest or stomach or around your upper lip. Or if paying attention to the breath is uncomfortable, which it is actually for a number of people, especially those who have had painful or traumatic experiences, pick something else like a saying, such as, you know, may I be peaceful, or a religious phrase like God is good, or something, whatever works for you. Or look in an image that's benign, you know, a pink flower outside your window, perhaps, or a, you know, some kind of religious icon, what have you. Okay, so you pick an object of attention, and then the first suggestion is intend to be mindful. So with words in your mind, say to yourself something like, I'm going to be mindful. Or more viscerally from the bottom up, get a feeling of what it's like to be mindful inside your body, or imagine being someone who is for you a real representative of mindfulness. So I'll be quiet for about 5 seconds while you do that. Okay, so that's the first suggestion. The second suggestion is to really relax. It's hard to be mindful when we're tense or stressed. Attention starts bouncing around then, skittering around. So take, for example, a long exhalation, which will stimulate the parasympathetic wing of your nervous system, which is the rest and digest wing that's very soothing and calming. You know, 2 or 3 long exhalations, and I'll be quiet. Really relaxing. And you could have your own ways as well, you know, imagining fluffy white clouds. Another nice one is to relax the tongue, because the rest and digest system, parasympathetic, begins in the mouth, if you think about it. So if you relax the tongue, which is full of parasympathetic nerve fibers, it also helps relax. Okay, so that's the second suggestion. And then in the third suggestion, open to the feeling of being cared about. In other words, bring to mind someone that you know cares about you. It may not be a perfect relationship, but there is a slice of that pie in which you know they care about you. You matter to them. They like you or appreciate you, maybe even cherish and love you. Whatever it is, someone in your life today or in your life in the past, could be a pet, could be a spiritual being, could be a actual person or an embodied person, if you will, a human. But open to the sense of being with that one and see if you can get a feeling of being cared about. And I'll be quiet again. It's natural and okay if your mind goes to the opposite, you know, feeling not cared about. But then if you can, when you notice that, bring the spotlight of attention back to the positive theme of, for sure, there's been at least one person in your entire life who's had good vibes for you, who's had goodwill for you, wishes you well, and open to the sense of being with that person and the feeling of being cared about. Often there's a sense of a kind of a softening in the heart, kind of a coming home, sinking in to being in the presence of someone who wishes you well. That's the third suggestion, feeling cared about. It's very calming to the mind. We're very social animals. And feeling cared about is the basis also for the next thing we're going to do, which is the fourth suggestion, which is help yourself feel as safe as you reasonably can. It's hard to be mindful of something moment to moment in a meditative way if we don't feel safe, because then, of course, we're going to be vigilant. And we evolved to be paranoid, as it were. So if you can, most people can afford to feel safer. So remind yourself that you're in a protected setting. You've got resources inside yourself and around you. You can afford to feel safer. You can afford to relax a sense of guardedness in your body, bracing against life, helping yourself feel as safe as you reasonably can. And again, I'll be quiet for a moment here. Okay, this one for some people is challenging. Some people get nervous about feeling safer because in their history, that's when you lower your guard and whap, you really get whacked. So as best you can, that's why I use the word reasonably, you know, safe. What is reasonable safety in your real life right now or in this moment as you listen to this interview or, you know, in your own meditation practice or at any moment in life? You know, can you afford to feel safer? This has become a very big area of inquiry for me lately because I've really come to appreciate how hardwired we are to feel unsafe and anxious as a background condition. And also we live in a time when, you know, we're surrounded with threat messages and frankly are often manipulated with regard to fear because that's a classic way to gain or hold on to political power. So, opening to and feeling as safe as you can. And that takes us to the fifth suggestion, which is a real nice one, which is open to and encourage, you know, feelings of well-being. They could be mild or soft or subtle. There may also be pain or sorrow or irritation, what have you. But see if you can hold them in a big ocean, an opening pool of well-being. Maybe bringing to mind something you're grateful for or glad about. Or just locating an underlying bubbling well of basic happiness, basic contentment deep down inside. You know, taking a few seconds here to open to and encourage happiness to unfold, maybe with a soft half smile on your face to kindle this, bringing to mind, you know, as I said, things you feel good about, opening to well-being. This is an important one because, I can explain later, there are mechanisms in the brain that stabilize attention when there are high levels of reward followed by the neurotransmitter dopamine. So when we feel good and steadily good and as good as possible, that helps steady the mind as well as confers all kinds of other benefits as the research on positive emotions has shown. So opening to, not forcing it, not straining, not resisting pain, but opening to and encouraging well-being. That's the fifth suggestion. And then the last one, the sixth suggestion, is to get a sense that whatever the benefits may be of your practice, whatever your practice is, including your practice right now in this little time here, get a sense that the benefits are sinking into you. They're going into you like water into a sponge or you know, heat of a cup of cocoa into your hands, maybe a jewel going into the treasure chest of your heart, that you're taking in the good here so that these benefits are becoming a part of you that you can take with you wherever you go. So taking a moment here right now to get a sense of whatever calmness, whatever peacefulness, whatever mindfulness has arisen for you in the last few minutes while I've been doing this with you, that it's actually going in. Okay, and that last suggestion is particularly important because the brain is biased, as you said at the very beginning here, Mike. The brain is biased toward negative experiences, or it's what I call Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. So we need to reverse that by deliberately relishing, savoring, soaking in, sinking into, as they sink into us, positive experiences, because that's how you build resources deep down inside. So those are the six suggestions that are very foundational. I, as someone who's meditated a long time, will still routinely use them because they're go-tos. You know, they're like the fundamentals, right? That Tiger Woods still practices putting, you know. Roger Federer still works on his tennis shots. The Buddha continued to meditate after his own awakening. So doing fundamentals like those six suggestions keep building foundations for mindfulness inside your own brain. So that's it.
Seems simple as folks. Somebody knows what they're doing. Talks to them. That actually made me. It was a very nice exercise, and I think people realize that people practice have some kind of mindfulness practice. As soon as somebody mentions it, you know, it acts for a moment. Like Gary focused again. But you know what I have to say? Because I want to re-say what I said. You know, about our brain being pre-programmed.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking as you were. Well, I mean, it's true in a sense. But I was thinking a little bit as you were going through your very wonderful little quick meditation thing, is that, you know, if the brain is actually inherently pre-wired for that, towards one end, actually none of us ability to do mindfulness practice and stuff. You know, it's ironic. The question really is that, over the hundreds of thousands of years, a couple of years it developed, yes, overly imaginative, not conducive to survival. But there must have been a lot of drivers, for this relaxed state, through religion, it may have been a ritual kind of more active calmness and sense. Yeah, and so it really does seem like, that even though we learned this more. I mean, the brain will go either way, but we learned this more to be sympathetically driven because we're in our dangerous, always been in a dangerous environment. But I just know so many people, do therapy, maybe do hypnosis or whatever. But some magical practices, meditation, all sort of ends up the same place a lot of times. And I've been amazed at how easy it is for people who want to do it, willing to do the practice, and answer their questions and explain that really not doing anything, that's the secret, how skillful they become on being much more mindful and much more calm in day-to-day life, being able to just accept what happens without, and say, look, I don't like it, but that's okay. I got to deal with it, so no point getting overly upset. And so you think it actually is there's a lot of neurosciences and not neuroscience stuff on the side of actually being programmed to be calm, to be mindful. I don't know if I said that quite well, but...
If I get you right, I think you're getting at I think the important question, which is, at one level, it's the fundamental question of, what actually is human nature, right? Good or bad,
right.
Loving or hateful, calm or crazed. And it also gets at the question of why, if the brain is so clearly biased toward negative experiences, and there are, dozens of studies on that point, there's just no question that there's what's called the negativity bias in the brain in many regards. Why, on the other hand, do most people, worldwide even people who are in really tough conditions, although not people who are in horrible conditions, but people in tough conditions, most people worldwide report that they feel basically happy. They wish things were different. They wish their kids had better schools. They wish access to fresh water was easier. They wish that, you know, the the media was not so crazy in America, whatever it is, but there's a basic mild happiness. So how do you square those, right? How do you square the negativity bias with basic mild happiness? And here's my resolution of that issue. I think that the evidence is huge that we evolved a kind of home base, as it were, with regard to the three, I'll do it like this. So the brain evolved essentially in three stages. First stage, let's call it the reptile brain, mostly organized around avoiding pain, kind of a simple, basic thing. Get away from threat. Don't be lunch today, bottom line it. Then came in, the early mammalian and sort of advanced reptilian and avian bird evolution, which was focused around, approaching rewards with more capacity to active, sympathetic arousal, the second branch of the vagus nerve, more ability to approach carrots rather than just avoid sticks, okay? And then I'll call that the rat brain. And then on top of that, evolved the primate and human brain, which is very organized around attachment, very organized around attaching to us love, language, cooperative planning, altruism, empathy, social skills of all kinds. We're profoundly the most social animal, the most loving animal on the planet. That's the attaching system. So those are the three systems, avoiding, approaching, and attaching, lizard, rat, human. Okay. Each of those three systems can function in two kinds of ways. You cannot get rid of the systems. I ask myself, what's the nature of the brain of an arahant? In other words, what's the nature of the brain of a Buddha or a saint? Or ourselves, dialed down a bit, when we're in a really good zone, self-actualizing, or in the zone, or really creative, or in a state of flow, or moving really pretty far on our own path of awakening. What's going on in that kind of brain? Because you cannot get rid of these ancient systems that, avoid harm, approach rewards, and attach to us. All right. I think what's going on in the brain when we're in a good zone, as you said, it's easy for people to, it's startlingly easy, actually, for them to move into really quite a good place. In just a few minutes, I'm sure you've had this experience yourself. Routinely, I'll give a talk or a workshop, whatever, and, we'll do a little practice. 10 minutes, the whole room has changed. People have lost their worries. They're not stressing about getting there on time. They're not grumbling in their mind. They're, really happy. 10 minutes. How'd that work? I think it's because the home base of the brain is calm, contented, and caring. In other words, in terms of the avoiding system, it defaults to when it's not threatened, when people are not threatened, they're not in pain, they're not attacked, they're not chemically disturbed, they're not hungry, they're not worried about loved ones and so forth, they become relatively peaceful and calm, characterized by a lot of parasympathetic activation in terms of the avoiding harm system. In terms of the approaching reward system, they feel already full. They're already okay. Yeah, they would wish for $1 million. Sure, why not? But basically, they're okay. They're contented. They feel like their cup is already pretty full. That's where the approaching system goes when people are not threatened, etc. And then last, in terms of the attaching system, people default to a basic quality of caring. They're nice. I'm routinely struck by the degree to which, even though, we hear so much about, war and conflict, ethnic cleansing, and so forth, which definitely is horrible and needs to be addressed. But as I say in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads, because that's what people pay attention to. The truth is, we're surrounded by 1,000 daily moments, 1,000 daily acts of easy cooperation with other people. People move aside when we walk toward them on the sidewalk. We adjust for them. People hold doors open. They're polite with strangers. They're easy. They're friendly. They're connected. We default to a state of caring. So that's our home base, and that's really good news. In other words, we don't have to scratch and claw our way up the mountaintop. We just simply have to relax and take our home back in the meadow. That's our true nature. That's what is deep down the case of the brain, in addition to whatever mysteriously could be the case in some kind of divine infusion coming through. Okay. The problem, though, is that Mother Nature also evolved hair trigger mechanisms to drive us from home at the crack of a twig or, today, a frown across the dinner table. And then, boom, those three systems flip into a different mode of operation. They move out of what I call the responsive mode, which is the home base of the brain, into the reactive mode when they're in fight or flight, right? Or in terms of the attaching systems, they're holding tight to us, and fearing and even attacking them. Red state, blue state, you know, sports teams, you know, kinship battles, stuff like that. People, when they feel threatened, really glom on to their group, whatever it is, and tend to fear an attack and dehumanize them. That's the challenge. So the challenge, to bottom line it, and I'd love to hear what you think about this, to bottom line it, the challenge is to be very aware of those hair trigger mechanisms and to not let ourselves be flipped into that reactive mode in bogus ways. Yes, there is a place for that reactive mode. You know, dealing with a car accident or revving up to manage some project at work or to come through for your kids, if they, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a place for that reactive mode. But if we routinely live there, driven from home in a kind of inner homelessness, we're then vulnerable to all the long-term negative health consequences, physical and mental, of chronic stress. And so the solution is to not let yourself be needlessly driven from home based on, you know, bogus threats coming at you or excessive reactivity to the people around you or excessive reactivity to the thoughts, and, you know, that arise in your own mind. And instead, clock as many minutes as you can each day in that responsive mode of those three systems, in your home base, in some basic sense of calm, contentment, and caring. And as you do, because neurons that fire together wire together, you will be strengthening the neural substrates of your home base, so it becomes increasingly your default. And it's like deepening your keel in the water every minute you clock in that responsive mode of calm, contented, and caring, because neurons that fire together wire together. So as your keel deepens in the water, it's harder and harder to knock you over. You know, life, the winds of life blow back and forth, right? But as your keel deepens, as you ground more and more increasingly in your home base of calm, contentment, and caring, it's harder and harder to make you upset. It's harder and harder to make you act badly and lose your cool and do stupid stuff. So to me, that's incredibly good news. It relates to the traditional saying, you know, take the fruit as the path. In other words, the goal is calm, contentment, and caring, including really profound levels of calm, contentment, and caring. That's the goal, but it's also the means to the end. In other words, it's the method, because every minute we clock in those states deepens and strengthens them.
See, I think, you know, I mean, a lot of people have probably done this, but they haven't paid much attention. But I remember the first few times I saw a brand new baby with a new mother.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they weren't drugged out or nothing, and you know, baby, you know, I was a little upset because they spanked my butt. I'd be upset too, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, coming out from a totally different world and stuff. But, you know, in a few moments, you can feed him, put him on the mom's, you know, tummy and breast, and him warm and clean. You know, instantly they go into a state that you talk about being calm and safe and secure and contented. I mean, they don't know it. They just automatically go there. You know, and then you watch the mother, and she goes there too. And, you know, and I can't think of, anything that's like more fundamental
yeah.
in humans than a birth. And the experience that people have with it, even males. I mean, it works, affects the male, too. You know, so it really seems like this calm center, you know, is probably the major reason human beings survive to evolve to where we are and not kill each other's off already. And so I think people need to go back and try to remember that. Maybe you can do an exercise someday and people can remember how it was to see the child be born or their nephew or, you know, somebody else, and just to realize that, you know, being calm and protected and safe is like a very natural state for us.
I think that's a lovely practice, and I'll probably invent a practice about that, you know. But you're right. I think people don't really appreciate the degree to which our natural condition is really kind of wonderful. You know, it's so easy these days to, in a sense, lose faith with what actually is the case, and to get caught up in, you know, these memes, I think, that are really prevalent these days, you know, in these dark days, you know, in these challenging times. I kind of think that's crazy, because all times are challenging in some ways. I'd rather live today than 30 years ago, when there was a real risk of a thermonuclear war, you know, when the U.S. and the Soviet Union had tens of thousands of nuclear warheads pointing at each other, each one of which was much more powerful than what destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, at the end of World War II in Japan. Or I'd rather live today than during World War II. I'd rather live today than, you know, during the 19th century, which was, you know, for 90% of the population, nightmarish out of Charles Dickens and all the rest of that, you know? So I think it's important to really, you know, do what one can, even as almost an act of courage, you know, a political act of courage, to keep returning awareness to the true goodness that's out there. We got to take care of the real tigers that are out there. But Mother Nature trained us to jump at paper tigers 1,000 times over to avoid, you know, avoid missing one real tiger, right? And so, yeah, that's it on that point. I think your point's super good, Mike. That's great stuff, what you're saying.
Thank you, thank you. You need to maybe explain this, you know, because what I find is, you know, people learning meditation or, you know, doing therapy or whatever is, you know, it's they've been conditioned, you know, that everything has to put a ton of work in, a ton of effort to get anything out of the world.
Okay.
You know, and you know from meditation is it's not actually, sometimes you have good effort in, but the secret of becoming calm and contented, even when you're upset, you know, to realize that you really don't even know if things are good or bad anymore in the long term.
Yeah.
You know, and you realize it's sort of negative right now, but you go, well, you know, things always change anyway. And as Buddha said, everything's changing. Heraclitus. So, you know, things, you know, like a bad one moment for us, and now all of a sudden something good happens. And I don't think people really understand that this whole thing is about learning, and you're going to be mindful. It's about not having to force things anymore. You know, not having to be the boss, not having to control, not be your own God. It's, you know, it's just about being present.
Right.
Dealing with what happens. You know, some planning ahead, of course, because, you know, we got a good, you know, good prefrontal cortex, we don't want to waste it.
Yeah.
But non-acting is so much more powerful than acting, but it's not passive.
Right.
You know, it's not apathetic.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very interesting idea. And, you know, there's a Zen saying that I think of here, which is that we should be with our mind like the skillful rider of a horse, not too tight nor too loose a rein. I think that's a lovely saying. And there's a variation on that. That's a Tibetan saying, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. Round and round it goes. In other words, both are true. There needs to be a kind of letting go, falling away, trusting, giving over, just sitting, as they say in Zen, shikantaza, just sitting. On the other hand, it's not easy to just sit, you know what I mean, without the mind being caught up in some form of wanting and planning and problem solving and worrying and muttering and fatitzling, or, you know, around. So it's a combination of the two. That's the art. And I think that, in my observation, there are people who err on either side. There are people who say, oh, just be with the moment. That's all you got to do. Well, first of all, they usually say that after 30 years of intense spiritual practice. You know, like their capacity to just be with the moment, give over to the non-dual awareness of everything, you know, it often was achieved either through a very rare sudden illumination that most people will never experience, or the end of a very long period of gradual cultivation. On the other side of it, boy, there are a lot of people that are kind of white-knuckling their way through meditation and being hard on themselves about it. So I think the essence here is what the Buddha called, of course, the middle way, you know, where you're not too tight nor too loose a rein. And I think there are two things that are really helpful, or maybe three, about that. Number one is, you know, really getting on your own side and having a basic stance of kindness and goodwill toward yourself. Because if you're really kind toward yourself, you will not fall into either of those pitfalls. On the one side, you will not fall into the pitfall of just sort of being kind of blobby about it. On the other side, you will not fall into the pitfall of being too hard on yourself. Whoops, there we are. I banged my phone there. Sorry about that. Anyway. Second thing, yeah, a felt sense of being loved, to whatever extent you can access that, the felt sense of being cared about. I've really come to appreciate, given our evolutionary heritage as social animals, how truly fundamental that is to mental health. It's interesting, last night I was reading this literature review sort of article surveying the research on loneliness, and how loneliness, which is more of a feeling, for example, some people can spend a fair amount of time by themselves and not feel lonely at all. Other people can be in the middle of crowds all day long and feel deeply lonely. Loneliness is a huge risk factor for various kinds of illnesses, physical illnesses, as well as, you know, lots of suffering and you know, mental disorders. So, you know, that's a way of saying or indicating how much we really need this felt sense of being cared about by others. And that can help the mind settle. Both these things can really help meditation, can really help the mind calm, you know, and come to this more effortless place of steadiness of mind and basic well-being. And then I'd say the third suggestion would be to let go. Continually focus on letting go. Let things fall away. If your mind's getting caught up in worrying, let that go. Let it just go. Don't invest in it. Don't feed it. You know, the language, I'm quoting the Buddha a lot because I think of him as Coach Buddha, frankly. I don't mean that in any disrespectful way because I have profound respect for him, but he was a coach. He was a great coach. And he said, first and foremost, take nothing on faith alone. See what works for you. That's what the most important test is. So he said that, you know, what works for you is to let go, is to not get caught up in desire or worry or irritation and so forth. Just kind of let it spin away. I use the metaphor of eddies in the stream. If people want to Google that Rick Hansen eddies stream phrase, they'll pull up an article I wrote about that that's pretty cool, I think. But anyway, in order to sum up here, I'll quote a teacher from Southeast Asia, Ajahn Chah, who's a major teacher for the Vipassana wing or mindfulness wing of Buddhism in the West. He said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. And if you let go completely, that's how to be completely happy.
I remember, like, the first time I went to, like, a really Insight Meditation Society for, like, a 9 or 10 day retreat, whatever it is.
Really?
My problem is, I don't know why you said it. Like I said, I need one of those tapered cushions. You know, that you kind of rest your thighs because everything else doesn't work for me. You know, so and I went up there and we had our Zen things, other cushions. You know, and it was like the most miserably painful experience. I mean, for minor stuff, okay, just never being comfortable and stuff. And you know, everybody trying to try this cushion, try that cushion. You know, but the only thing that was sort of nice about the whole thing was actually. It was like the 9 days of you know, being utterly uncomfortable unless if I'm walking around. But, you know, the very first meditation, you know, sitting there and my mind going back and forth, and, you know, it dawned on me that, you know, it's the whole thing is not about anything they tell you it's about. You know, it's sort of a trick. You know, and the real thing they're trying to teach you is to just say, you know what, whatever happens is useful. So, when I could not go from one inhale to one exhale in a 15-minute period without, you know, my mind making up all these great inventions or just wandering off or whatever else, and, you know, whether I took a breath and, you know, just space out, and there's a lot of mental hiatuses, and sometimes you can actually pay attention to your breathing without too much chatter for a pretty long time.
Yeah.
You know, dawned on me real quickly that these are all the same. I mean, the whole point is just, like, not worry about it. Just do it. Experience it. Take the gift to come with it. Take the lesson to come. You know,
In other words, it's about being present. That's all it is.
Yeah.
The trick is, of course, to stay present. But bottom line, it boils down to being present.
I think that comes with the daily practice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not a big meditationist. I'm kind of like hyper, so. You know, when I went to meditation, I started to figure out why I was so hyper.
Yeah.
Actually, I figured it out. But
you're more like
a guy in the office.
That's cool.
You know, I mean, just you have different personalities, different temperaments, different characters.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, it's more like a kind of, you know, what you do is you just practice with what I have. So I'm walking down the street, see something, I stop, and, you know, be mindful. And after a while, it sort of gets to be a habit. You know, and I can say sometimes, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, you're saying after you're mindful or not, you go, I wasn't even thinking about it. I was just walking down the street, see what, you know, experiencing what's going on. You know, I'm looking at people, thinking sometimes nice thoughts. But the point I want to make, though, is that this is about the most important point of all that I've found in therapy. And it's so rare to find people that actually somehow make it through childhood, you know, and realizing their wholesome qualities, realizing their many more unwholesome qualities,
But inherently, they truly like themselves. I'm not talking about antisocial personality disorders, but they truly realize that they have inherent value. You know, which may go to a more metaphysical point. But to some people, just, you know, no matter what happens to them, how bad it is, they get through it, they deal with it. But they do have this certain kind of contentment and happiness because they don't feel like anybody punished them, I mean, internally for what they did, and maybe getting punished because somebody off. But it's just this basic contentment with who you basically are, with no rewards, no descriptions, you know, no requirements. Yeah, and I was curious, just like, I mean, how does it happen that, you know, it's so rare to be in this place, which seems to me to be a natural place you should be anyway? Period.
I think you're right. And I myself like the imagery of we've been driven from home. Because the idea is that, you know, it's a lot easier to come home than it is to go home, in a sense. You know, it's a lot easier to, you know, as I say in Tibet, remove the obscurations to radiant, wonderful, true nature. Or rather than, you know, scratch and claw and build up, you know, some, you know, really, really good true nature. I like the idea of falling back into something wonderful. And something that's our true nature.
Can I go slightly metaphysical on you?
Oh, sure. Like, it's your show, yeah. Go for it.
No, but I mean, you're the kind person who comes on and tells everybody all these wonderful things. So it's really your show. I just have to do my little part. Sometimes
good.
Yeah, sometimes
no,
that's
go
great,
for it.
It's okay.
I'm metaphysics. All right, here we are.
But you know, because you did talk about, you know, I mean, we talked about Erhans and, you know, Jesus talked about the saints and blah 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 blah. But you know, it does seem like the set of people, you know, that you come across, not too many of them, but there's more than people think. You know, it's almost as if, you know, being when they are born, you know, it's as if they're, I don't know if it's tough to find brain things or stuff, but I'm just gonna say the mind, you know, seems to be different than other people's minds, even before anything. And it reprograms the brain differently. So, you know, talking about incarnation, as you well know, and people talk about it, but it does really seem like some people, given the same genetics, same family, same everything else, and there's a lot of variability in there, you know, their brains are different from birth. And I don't think it's a biological thing per se. It seems to be, as you watch them grow up and interact, it seems to be like a more intrinsic nature to them, which, you know, it's, you know, I happen to think that the, you know, the mind and the brain aren't the same thing. You got to have the brain or you have the mind, but there's something else in the universe that people have missed, don't want to talk about, or we call it religion or call it God, and they get into a bunch of semantic arguments over it. But do you think there's something related to this? I mean, just from this, I mean, anyway, in neuroscience, have you ever looked at this? You know, twin studies or long-term
the ideas studies? Of, well, how can I put it? You know, for sure, as you know, you're a physician, right? You know, so, you know, statistically, on the average, you know, DNA, in other words, purely genetic factors, you know, established at conception, let's say, they probably account for about a third ballpark of the variation in things like personality and temperament. You know, in some cases, they account for a lot more with some individuals, but averaging across the population and averaging across, you know, personality and temperament, you know, genetics is about a third to 40%, especially when you do well-controlled studies that take into account the fact that in twin studies, most, which are the basis for this whole debate between nature and nurture, as you know, most twin studies are done with twins who are adopted into middle-class populations or upper-middle-class groups. Where the impact of the environment is restricted. So when you correct for that statistically, it leads you to realize that the impact of nature has been historically overestimated in research. And, you know, the latest view is that it's closer to a third. So ballpark, you know, about a third is genetics. But I think you're talking about something beyond that, you know. You're talking about some kind of influence that seems to be related to a previous life, correct?
Well, actually, I mean, I think I'm going to say that, but it actually goes back more to Jung. You know, it's collective.
Sorry,
you know,
say that louder, Mike. I'm listening, and I really want to catch what you're saying.
I mean, maybe more it has to do with, you know, Carl Jung, which I admire very much. I think he's a really good thinker in the collective psyche. You know, and initially in his early life, I mean, he really thought everything was, you know, programming of the brain, biological, hereditary.
Yeah.
And I remember coming across an article like 50 years later, a footnote, and says, you know, I'm not sure I was actually totally right about my initial points of view that it's just hereditary. You know, because
right.
he said, I've talked to so many patients that it seems like there's another factor in the universe. You know, and so it almost seems like, you know, people have a collective unconsciousness and all these things and, you know, and things, but it almost seems like there has to be, like, a new collective consciousness, you know, for human beings, that we're actually, you know, evolving as a group to a much higher expression. And I think this collective unconsciousness, I mean, it's hard to get around it.
I'm assuming you mean you're talking about something that's out there somewhere, let's say, other than what could be understood in very conventional terms as culture, right? I mean, that's where,
culture, it's not culture upbringing, it's not our biology.
Right.
It's not religion.
Somewhere in the realm of spirit.
I call it a word. The best word I ever come across is like the source of awareness. Just knowing
what?
That you know.
What kind of awareness?
Just knowing that you know, like being able to observe, just observing, just intending, just caring, just knowing that you're present.
Yeah. Not to get semantic, but just for me, you know, having had this kind of conversation over the years a lot, you know, I grew up in the human potential world, and I think it's really helpful to make a clear distinction between what are we talking about that could be understood in fairly conventional ways, as, for example, the subtle effects on people of cultural influences that they don't even realize, right? Versus, and this is where I think, see, Jung was ambiguous about this, as you probably know. A fair amount of what he was talking about arguably could be attributed to essentially the hard wiring in DNA, essentially, through genetic pathways that were the third that I talked about, whereby, you know, general tendencies would manifest through imagery that's kind of universal, you know, like the tree or the mandalas and stuff like that. You know, the mechanism of action there is conventional in a sense of DNA, genetics, evolution, you know, psychology and media and so forth. But in addition to that, that's where it gets really interesting about whether there's some kind of mystical influence. And I think that's more what you're going to, right?
You know, I gotta be careful with my words because I know you're such a pragmatic, down-to-earth person, you know.
but I'm cool with that. That said, yeah, I do think that there is something out there. I think of it as the X factor, and I think it's beyond the knowledge of Western science. And there, as a evidence-driven person, I think even if you eliminate 99% of the evidence for this as, you know, not valid, there remains that 1%. And I think we should have a truly scientific attitude. And at the end of the day, and I know we're wrapping up, bow to the mystery.
Well, I think we're at the end of the show, but I want to thank you, Rick. And everybody, go out, go to the bookstore, get Buddha's Brain. It's an excellent explanation of neuroscience and how to be happy. And it's a lot of good exercises in it. And it's really one of the best books I ever read. And also go to rickhanson.net or wisebrain.org and to find out more information. And I really recommend you guys go do this. It'll make a big difference in your life, and it's like a really good investment of your money and time.
Better than
going to football games, probably. So thanks, Rick. I appreciate you.
I appreciate you too.
You're the best, as always, you. And again, isn't that time you have a new book coming out pretty soon?
That'll be out in September. But, you know, if people want, they can go to my website. They can also sign up for this little newsletter I do called Just One Thing, which at this point has well over 16,000 subscribers it's really practical and heartfelt and direct and simple. It's like one practice each week, you know. The one I actually just did was called See Progress, which included really appreciating your good qualities and not feeling defeated by fear.
Well, I'm going to cut us off in a second, so take care, and
thank you.
I really appreciate you. You're a good fellow.
Oh, thank you. Feelings mutual. All right, you take care. Bye-bye, everybody.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you for joining Dr. Michael John Kell on Mind, Brain, and Body. Please tune in next Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time for another edition of Mind, Brain, and Body, right here on Voice America Health and Wellness.